this will happen all across the nation in states like Tennessee that are controlled by these extremists. And so this is going to set a very dangerous precedent for democracy in our country. And we hope that the people of the nation will continue to keep an eye on Tennessee and stand with these young people who are simply saying that they want to live, that they want to be able to go to school without it feeling like a war zone, and that they want to feel safe. And so my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, they can expel us, but we know that what they're doing is unconstitutional. We're going to challenge it in court. We're going to challenge it in the streets. And what they're doing is just amplifying the movement that is calling attention to the crisis of these mass shootings and the inaction of lawmakers who are beholden to the NRA, who are beholden to the Tennessee Firearms Association, and who are ignoring the will of the people. That's not democracy. That's authoritarianism. But we will not be intimidated.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. Justin Jones, one of three Democratic Tennessee state representatives who face an expulsion vote on Thursday, author of The People's Plaza, 62 Days of Nonviolent Resistance, which has a foreword by Bishop William Barber, and Esri Tyler, national organizer for March for Our Lives and a student at Vanderbilt University. Again, the Tennessee governor, Bill Lee, signed yet another deregulation of guns in Tennessee in a Beretta gun factory. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
Listen to the skies. Listen to the sound. Something on the land. Something going down. Down dressers speeding by life. Fever's heart, burning rivers to cross. Walls of Babylon, material noise. Thinking they've touched the moon. Freedom takes a rocket blast. Just another day, like yesterday. Rocking my heart, rocking the rails. Woman like you, times like this.
And good morning, everybody. And I am Paul Rowland, and we have a very special, I call her now occasional co-host, used to be my regular second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler. I'll wish you good morning and then talk about that song I played. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, morning, Paul.
So that was John Trudell, and that came out... that was a AKA Graffiti Man, made a big splash in Indian country and beyond. So I think where he first started to get a little broader recognition. Anyway, that came out just over 20 years ago. It kind of passed me by last year that it came out in 1992 on a cassette, if you can believe it, and kind of passed hand to hand. And yeah, John Trudell, he left us just 8 years ago. And he would have been 77 on February 15th, a real force in the Native world. And actually, one of the things we'll be talking about, I'm going to just sort of list them, and then you can take them in the order you want, Jackie. We are going to be talking about the 20th anniversary of the, no, the 50th anniversary of the occupation of Wounded Knee, where, actually, I'm not sure if and how much Trudell had a role, but he was, for a few years at least, a chairman of the American Indian Movement. And we can talk about that. Also, you have a new article out on Atmos called Colorado River, the Navajo Nation's Forever Home is in Crisis. The Vatican issued a statement apparently repudiating the Doctrine of Discovery, which we talked about quite a bit on this program, and you talked about independently on the show you did for a while. Maybe a few other things. But before that, I just wanted to introduce you for anybody who doesn't know you. You're a Native American writer and activist enrolled in the Navajo Nation and of Yankton Dakota descent on your father's side. And you kind of started, I guess, well, I don't know, as far as I know, started your activist career. I'm sure you did a lot before that. publicly, you co-founded Eradicating Offensive Native Mass History, which seeks to end the use of Native American racial groups as mascots and stereotypes, which has had quite a bit of success over the last 5 or 10 years. And I could say more, but once again, good morning. And maybe we'll start out. Everybody else is talking about the indictment, arrest, and arraignment of Donald Trump. Anything you feel like saying about that?
Yeah, just that it's. I did watch the video of him being, turning himself in, and it was. I thought it pretty satisfying to watch, and then the craziness with Congresswoman, what's her name, Marjorie
Taylor Greene. Yeah,
Taylor Greene. Yeah, and it's just. Of course, that one guy showed up, the fake Jewish congressman, Santos, George Santos. And it was just I'm curious to see. You know, I haven't gone through all the different things that were released with the the 34 felony counts. I'm looking forward to digging into that more. So I've been working on a couple articles, so I haven't had a lot of time to do that. So,
mm-hmm. And I guess there is one other thing of current events that you can comment on or not as you wish, but there were a couple major progressive victories, the Chicago mayoral race and the race for the Supreme Court judge in Wisconsin, which depending which way it went, and it went to the progressive candidate, it makes a major difference in both state and national politics. I'm sure it's too early to tell if the Native vote there played a role, because there is a fairly large Native population in Wisconsin. That's another thing we've talked a lot about. They talked on Democracy Now! That, you know, the youth vote has played a major role in some of these races. And obviously youth, women, people of color, including indigenous people, are major factors in the sort of the tide, the turning of the tide of the political landscape, if the Republicans weren't so hell-bent on gerrymandering and manipulating the laws, et cetera, to stem that tide.
Yeah, definitely. I was really excited to see. I don't think I can pronounce her name.
Right.
I think I think she had a whole campaign video that explained how to pronounce her last name. the progressive judge who won, and... it's really exciting that now there is a chance that that the heavily gerrymandered voting maps will be reconsidered, and possibly struck down. So, how the Republicans have been locking themselves into power is creating these gerrymandered maps that will basically prevent most of the people from being heard. And so, a chance to get a crack, and of course. The Republican, the kind of Republican candidate, you can call it that, was not interested in, was definitely supportive of the gerrymandering. And so that's exciting. And yeah, so, and of course, I think Wisconsin is the only state there that is looking at, actually considered Trump's claims that the election was stolen and actually almost threw out Biden's victory in Wisconsin. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court only ruled against doing that by one vote, I think the Supreme Court member, the Wisconsin Supreme Court member, was a Republican who crossed the line, but he only voted against it because he said that they waited too long to file, and not because it was. Yeah, so it was, there's a lot of major issues, including abortion, that are really on the line there. Her role there could make a huge difference. My Aunt Kathy, she married into the Oneida tribe in Wisconsin. Of course, Sharice Davids, so my cousins are Powellises. They live there in Wisconsin. And then, Powellis is a pretty well-known Iroquois family. And then, of course, Sharice Davids, her tribe is there as well, the Ho-Chunk Nation in Wisconsin, but Congresswoman Sharice Davids.
So I just got to ask you, I can't tell for sure, are you on a speakerphone or not?
Oh, yes, I am.
Maybe you could get off that possibly. There's just a little bit of a kind of a tinny echo, sort of, at least in my headphones. I don't know how it is in people's car radios. Anyway, thank you for that. So yeah, let's get into the meat of the, there's a lot to, on the plate. Maybe just, it might be top of your mind. I don't know if you maybe want to start with your new article. As I mentioned, Colorado River, the Navajo Nation's forever home is in crisis on Atmos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Navajo Nation, of course, went before the Supreme Court, finally. I mean, this is something that's been, for 20 years going on. And, I was asked by Atmos to write about it. And, in late March, the Navajo Nation went before the Supreme Court for oral arguments on its rights, consideration of its rights to the Little Colorado River, which is, of course, a tributary of the Colorado River. And there is this thing called the Winters Doctrine that states that, with the formation of a reservation, implied in that is that they're going to be able to pursue a life there. And part of that right to life is water, is the right to water. And so my family are from the Western Navajo. My grandparents and my mom's family ranch and farm along the Little Colorado River, not far from where it the what they call the confluence, where it enters the Colorado River. And my other family's from Cameron and Gray Mountain, and I think Bodaway Gap's a little closer to the actual confluence, but we have relatives there too, but we're pretty close to there. So that's where we've ranched and farmed for years, for generations. And so I wrote about that, and it was really neat because I don't often get when you come from a family, my grandparents, and I mentioned this on the show before, that my grandparents were traditional Navajos, and they didn't speak English, and they didn't get running water in their home until this century, till the 21st century. And so going home to the Navajo Nation and everything, it was just surreal. I mean, I had such respect for my grandparents and their siblings, my great aunts and uncles, and they just had such a way of carrying themselves. My grandparents didn't go to boarding school. So they were really, I don't know if untouched is the right word, but they were just not beaten down by white society in that way, internally.
Is that something that was because of the nature of the, how big and the Navajo Nation reservation is, and how kind of, how widespread people are and kind of way in the outback?
Yeah,
did a lot of them able to escape that for that reason?
I've read studies that say that only like 5% of my grandparents' generation went to school on the
amazing.
Navajo Nation. So the Navajo Nation has 400,000 citizens. And so a lot of our grandparents did not go to boarding school. It's just a small number who did. And so it's... my generation's grandparents, I should say, like people who came of age in the 30s, very uncommon for an elder when I was growing up to be able to speak English. I mean, it was sort of like, wow, they can speak English. I mean, really, it was not very common, up until recent. My mom's generation is a different story, of course. But I mean, yeah, my grandparents' generation, most elders did not speak English.
So they were able to keep both their language and their customs a lot more than a lot of other tribes were able to do.
Yeah. I think a lot of times, I'm sort of shocked when I talk to people from other tribes and realize that they don't know that Navajos are almost entirely full-blood. It's like 90% demographically. And that hundreds of thousands of Navajos speak their language, speak Navajo. It's a living language. It's a living, like I always say, it's the size of Ireland, has the population of Iceland, is larger than 18 member states of the United Nations. It's a country within a country, literally, but even a lot of Native people don't really appreciate that. They don't realize, oh, wait, we have, over, 300,000 full-blood Navajos, 200,000 which speak their language fluently. What does that mean? When they do TV shows and movies about featuring Navajo characters, they almost never cast Navajos, even though, you know, like if you were to be a tribal cop on the Navajo Nation in 1972, even, you know, I would say 2002, you really couldn't do your job very well unless you could speak Navajo, because most of the elders didn't speak English. How you couldn't interview people, you have to constantly bringing a translator along. It is not possible to do your work on the Navajo Nation until fairly recently without speaking Navajo. It would not have been possible.
Of course, the other side of that is the terrible tragedy of how much was lost and so much of the rest of Indian country.
Yeah, I've been dealing with a story right now about, I don't know if you want to talk about it on this show, but the issue of, you know, of the way in which people who basically have played the role of culture bearers and even language teachers on different reservations, different communities, have turned out to be sexual predators. And, of course, you know, the whole thing with Winona LaDuke, her losing that case of protecting a sexual predator, Michael Dahl, that happened a few days last week.
Well, let's hold off on that one. Let me just read to kind of continue on that theme of your article about the Colorado River. If you don't mind, I'm just going to read one succinct paragraph that kind of sums up what the nature of it is. You say, now the Supreme Court is considering whether the U.S. government has lived up to its treaty promises to provide a forever home for the Navajo people to live our traditional pastoral life. At issue is whether those promises in the 1868 treaty included access to water and whether the lack of it constitutes a breach of promise. I know that the water rights is just a huge issue across the West, and including, you know, the finally tribes fighting for their right to be included in that, which has been a huge battle in a lot of places. So have you heard anything about what the likely outcome, what the different, just give us a little bit about some of the
well,
details.
So before I get into the outcome, which won't be, I think we won't hear till June. It was really interesting for me to research this because, you know, having grown up with a family running a ranch on the Little Colorado, I think it was really interesting to learn about the legal sort of history behind our rights to the water. And so when we talk about treaties, we are talking about not only international law between two sovereigns, but also we're talking about contract law, right? And so the question before the court, the Supreme Court right now, is, so, you know, when the reservation was formed, what was, you know, when the treaty was signed in 1868, and this was after Navajo people had been put into a concentration camp for several years by the U.S. government. And so... I cite a lot of a book written by my grandmother's aunt, a book called Big Horse the Warrior, right? That was my, it's about the life story of my grandmother's grandfather, Gus Big Horse, who was a 16-year-old, when the Americans came in and then murdered his parents in the 1860s. And he was living near Mount Taylor in New Mexico. And he came home from hunting, and he found his parents dead. His mother was a silver jeweler maker, so she was killed at her forge by American soldiers. And his father was a trader. He was Navajo, but he was a trader. He went around in a wagon selling things to other Navajos. And so his father was making a bridle to sell. And so they were murdered while they were doing their work. And so he fled to the top of Mount Taylor and met other survivors, other boys, particularly who were orphans, and they sort of went around trying to help Navajo people hide out and escape. And then joined up with Chief Manuelito, who was leading the resistance. There were Navajos who never turned themselves in, and they were living near Navajo Mountain, which is sort of near the northern Arizona-Utah border. And they were, you know, growing crops and feeding the resistance and continuing to do raids on the U.S. Army. But Chief Barbancito, he was the chief that was, he willingly turned himself in so that he could provide emotional support to the people in the camp. and there were several thousand Navajos, and many died. And so Gus Dayhorse's wife, who was my ancestor, was came of age in that camp as a young, as a, from a girl to a young woman. And it was pretty vicious. You know, they had over a 300-mile walk from the Navajo Nation to the concentration camp called Bosque Redondo, or called Huelde in Navajo. And they, you know, those soldiers allegedly, you know, would, if a woman was giving birth, they would shoot her and her child. You know, elders who were too weak to go on would be shot as well on this thing. So it was quite traumatic. And then, of course, they were forced to, once they got there, to build homes for the officer, the American army officers, and then try, and it just didn't work out. They weren't able to grow crops there. This wasn't the right location. And also, they were being raided by, I think, Comanches. And so, so anyway, they, so when Barbancito went to negotiate this treaty, he was explaining that within our Navajo traditional beliefs, that we are supposed to live between the four sacred mountains and the four sacred rivers. And this is called the Dine Ta, or the Dine Pekea. It's our homeland, right? And the, everything works within the homeland, our ceremonies, our well-being. And this is why we can't grow crops in other places. And so he was, so then, so this was the goal of getting the, our homeland back was to, which is what the Navajo reservation is. It is the Navajo homeland. It encompasses almost all of it. And so a Navajo belief is that the prayers that were given, in while they were still doing ceremony while they were in the concentration camp. So the prayers they did and everything helped them regain their homeland, right? You know, and so, but so the idea is that we, that, that there was an agreement made with the U.S. government that we would be able to retain our pastoral lifestyle and maintain ourselves, because it was costing the U.S. taxpayers like $1 million a year to basically starve us. So it was like, well, that's, you know, cheaper for them just to take care of themselves. And so this is where the contract breach, the breach of contract is located, is within the idea that they didn't provide water. And in fact, I the detail on how water was misused, particularly groundwater for flaring coal or uranium. You know, they're even now trying to do sort of more uranium mining, and so which impacts the groundwater. And
not to
so,
mention Las Vegas and Phoenix and other
Vegas and Phoenix and the, you know, so the other component of this is the Winters Doctrine, which I mentioned before. It was a case brought forward by a Montana tribe in the early 1900s, and basically created a doctrine with me, which was that there was implicit in when they created the reservation. This is a tribe that was not pastoral, was not an agricultural tribe, but a nomadic tribe, a hunter, you know. And so when they agreed to take on this lifestyle, the U.S. government agreed to provide, to make sure that the resources were there, including water. And so this, whenever a case is decided for one tribe, one federally recognized tribe, it's in Indian federal law, the case law, it applies to all federally recognized tribes, and so it sets precedent for every tribe. And so this Winters Doctrine was applied by the U.S. government in the case of the Colorado River Compact. On behalf, they invoked it on behalf of like 20 some tribes along the Colorado River, and they invoked it not for the water in the Colorado, but for the tributaries that go into the Colorado, and this would include the Little Colorado River. So the Navajo Nation was not able, and they did, the tribal council did request to basically advocate for their rights to the Colorado River water, particularly the tributaries that go into it, but they were refused because the federal government was doing it on our behalf. And so, so this is what they're considering. And of course, it is a really tense time with, you know, drought climate change, and so demand for river for the Colorado River water is intense, and so where you have all these states, utility, particularly in California and Arizona, challenging the Navajo Nation's right to water.
No doubt, and so the images of Lake Powell and the others over the past decade just going down and down and down and down and down. Incredibly dramatic, I'm sure, spread around the world. and started to ironically open up the visibility of some of the even some pre, you know, old native paintings and stuff, art, old evidence of their being there. But anyway, so I was just curious. Have you been following? It's sort of been in the back of my mind with all the precipitation in the Sierras. Do you know if that has actually filled some of those reservoirs back up?
I haven't checked in the last. Been working on this other story, but I have heard that it has been helping, and I'm hoping that yeah, I used to live in Nevada City, California, so a lot of my people I know there are like have been watching photos of them under snow and stuff and in April, and but yeah, I hope it does make it less of an issue, because I think maybe it'll make the Supreme Court justices more generous, and really all the tribe is asking for is an assessment of their rights, which, which is not as, it's not as, basically, we do have all the states, the lower Colorado River states to really challenging the Navajo Nation's rights. And but tribes under water law, tribes are first in, so they have the first rights, and so because we were here first, and so senior water rights, so that's where it's very threatening to other entities, the fact that when a tribe tries to assert its rights to the water, because as we see here in Oregon with the Klamath River Basin, that the tribes do have senior water rights, and that means that farmers can't use, they then become secondary users.
Well, that would be really looking for that, because as you said, any major court decision affecting one tribe affects the other, so I'm sure Indian Country will be looking at that. And so likely in June that'll come down?
Yeah. Okay. And, I spoke to folks that I know who are, law professors, and my Uncle Sam Gloria, who's a retired lawyer, and they don't think the Navajo Nation has a great chance of winning this. But at the same time, it won't really harm. It just means the situation will be the same. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really because it's just asking for an assessment. And but if they do win, then that would be quite good, which would actually help a lot of tribes, because we're not the only. I think, like I said, there's like 20 some tribes that the U.S. government has invoked the Winters Doctrine on their behalf for the Colorado River,
right,
for tributaries. So there's a lot of tribes that are in the same boat we are. But the Navajo Nation is the Western Navajo, where the little Colorado River drains through, is probably the largest. It's a lot of communities along the Navajo communities along that river, and the little Colorado River starts in on the Apache Reservation, and so it goes quite a ways, but it floods, and it provides a lot of water, and that's where my family would grow crops along the along the Little Colorado.
Well, we're about halfway through. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular host of Wednesday Talk Radio, and I have back on me my former regular co-host, now occasional co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, talking about her article. And you can go to that at atmos.earth, atmos.earth, Colorado River, the Navajo Nation's forever home is in crisis. From that, I was hoping the current consequences of the colonization process, I was hoping we could go back to this really interesting, kind of came out of nowhere. I know that many various delegations of indigenous people have traveled to the Vatican, have agitated, written articles, tried to raise public awareness about the whole doctrine of discovery, which dates back to several papal bulls from the 1400s. And it just came out. I'll just read this really quickly. That this is from Al Jazeera. The Vatican has rejected. And I want to put that in quotes for now and get your take on it if you've looked into this in depth. The doctrine of discovery, a 15th century concept laid out in so-called papal bulls that were used to justify European Christian colonialists seizure of indigenous lands in Africa and the Americas. In a statement on Thursday, the Vatican's Development and Education Office said the theory, which still informs government policies and laws today, was not part of the Catholic Church's teachings. And I could go on. I kind of want to read a little bit more later, but what's your take on all that?
Yeah, I think it's great, actually. And the Doctrine of Discovery, the way it relates to the United States is that it was actually a doctrine created by Chief Justice John Marshall in the case Johnson v. McIntosh in 1823. There were a series of cases. They're called the Marshall.
So that's 200 years ago this year. Oh my goodness! Interesting.
Yeah. There's a series of cases called the Marshall Trilogy, which are three cases that are fundamental to Indian federal law in this country, and this is one of them. And what it basically was he had two American men who both had, they're American U.S. citizens, and they both had claim to the same land. They had deeds, property deeds that they had gotten in different ways, one through the state and the other one through the tribe. They had gone and negotiated directly with the tribe. So the question was, who has fee simple title to the land, right? And so I should have written this down, but I was listening to Bob Miller of Arizona State University Law School. He used to teach here at Lewis and Clark, and he wrote a book on the Doctrine of Discovery. He's written a lot on these issues, and he recently had a sort of Doctrine of Discovery 200-year sort of online conference. And so and it's interesting because I guess you have to realize the state of this country 200 years ago. This was a brand new country. There was not a lot of case law, right, or precedent. You have a Supreme Court justice, Chief Justice, who was just kind of drawing upon legal precedent willy-nilly all over the world, right? Whatever he can kind of take and use. And he doesn't have a really great law library either, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so, he's using secondary sources to quote this papal bull. And in fact, I can't remember if there's an essay that he basically cribbed off an essay written about it. And so, but this was basically to establish these papal bulls. The idea was to use these papal bulls, which were issued during the Age of Discovery, when Spain and Portugal were out, exploring in the 15th and 1600s and 15th and 16th century. And basically, there was a dispute between Portugal and Spain over, who had rights to basically colonize certain areas of the world. And so this was a series of papal bulls written by the Pope to try to negotiate between these two powers. And that's why, he drew a line, and that's why everything east of that line is for Portugal, and everything west of that longitude is for Spain, and that's why Brazil is Portuguese and the rest of the
Portugal really got the short end of that stick.
Yes, it did. So what they basically said was that these two papal bulls done by two different popes basically stipulated that that because that when they're only discovering European Christian nations, once they land at a place and discover it and, plant their flag in there and everything, then they have, the fee simple title reverts to them, right? It reverts to the ruler of that country. And that the only title that indigenous people have, native nations had, was that of animals, of use and occupancy, which basically then declares that we're not fully human, right? And so so what they would do is, they would sail up, and usually they go to the mouth of a river, and they would claim the entire watershed on behalf of their king or queen. And so this practice became the basis of the United States government to fee simple title to our land. Marshall made the argument that the United States, even though it did not exist at that time, in 1493 and 1550, which I think were the years that the papal bulls were issued, but that it inherited the status of discovering European Christian nation because it was a colony of England at the time. Britain didn't officially exist until like Queen Anne's time, around 1702 or so. At the time they were an English colony, right? And so at the time England was still under the Pope, right? Henry VIII had not created the Church of England yet. So this is how the legal basis of the United States claims to a lot of the law that it claims, anything not under directly under treaty. So for the United States to take this up seriously, what the Vatican has said, the Vatican basically said that foreign powers have misused these bulls, right? And they could be right. I mean, it was obvious.
Let me just read that, because I have it right here. That's the next thing I was going to read, is the next paragraph, because I think we need to talk about this. The statement from the Vatican said the papal bulls were, quote, manipulated for political purposes by competing colonial powers in order to justify immoral acts against indigenous peoples that were carried out at times without opposition from ecclesiastical authorities. And then it has some more. In a way, that's kind of CYA, isn't it? Cover your ass. I mean, they weren't manipulative. There were political purposes behind those that were then used by. I mean, that seems a little disingenuous to me, but.
Well, the Vatican is not fully owning its own role in this, and sort of passing the bucket. Certainly, the way Chief Justice Marshall used it was opportunistic, and certainly this country did not regard itself as a Catholic country in 1823. Quite the contrary, and.
Let's face it. I mean, they say that, what's the language of it? That they gave them basically the right to pillage, kill, and take captive essentially any heathen, savages. I mean, it's right there in the language of the bulls.
Yes. Yeah. I'm reading here. In 1452, Pope Nicholas V issued the Dum Diversus, which authorized King Alfonso of Portugal to, quote, subjugate the Saracens and pagans and any other unbelievers and enemies of Christ, and, quote, reduce their persons to perpetual servitude, take their belongings, including land, to convert them to you and your youth and your successors, the kings of Portugal. And then in 1455, Pope Nicholas V issued the Romanus Pontifex, which is the second papal bull, which extended Portugal's authority to conquer the lands of infidels and pagans for, quote, the salvation of all, in order to pardon their souls. It granted Portugal a specific right to conquest in West Africa and to trade with Saracens and infidels in designated areas. These bulls were used to justify the Atlantic slave trade. So, yeah, they were, and these particular popes, one of them was Pope Nicholas V. Wasn't he a member of early famous? These were all kind of real. they were very quite characters themselves. And the thing is that this response from the Vatican is really coming from the efforts of Canada, right? And
right, because a year ago Pope Francis went to Canada and apologized for the taking children captive and abusing them and killing them in the residential schools. It kind of grew out directly out of that, yeah.
Well, actually, the Canadian government also paid for two delegations to go to the Vatican. So they paid for a delegation of First Nations people and also a delegation of Métis people to go and meet with the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of stuff the U.S. government never does.
Right.
I think Canada just has more of a, obviously Canada has a terrible history with Native nations there, but it also does seem to devote more resources to, even with the MIW thing, I know that that commission that went around the country to collect stories, the Canadian government put $50 million Canadian dollars towards that effort, and they've also done a Truth and Reconciliation, initiative.
That MMIW That's missing and murdered Indigenous women, just for people.
Yes. And so, I mean, in Canada, there's just, I mean, your Canadian First Nations people, they have so much more money to travel around the world and push their issues, you know, because the Canadian government funds them to do it. We don't have that here in the United States at all. And so we aren't able to address these issues at the level with the full support. I mean, when a delegation is sent by the Canadian government, then they get an audience with the Pope, and they did, you know.
Right.
And so, and that was covered nationally in Canada on the national news live. We would never get that here in the United States.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine a Truth and Reconciliation Commission on colonization and the treatment of Indigenous peoples, but also it'd have to be on slavery as well.
It would be really, you know, I think American Indians, United States, are far more invisible than First Nations and Métis people are in Canada. And Canada is a much smaller country. I was interviewed recently by a Canadian reporter, and I was talking about the Pretendian issue, and you know, you realize that a study done by the Kellogg Foundation in 2017 found that 30% of white people think they have Native ancestry. That's about 80 million people. But that's still double the population of Canada. I mean, Canada is only like 40 million people. You know, it's so Native people are a larger percentage of the population. There's more Native people in the United States.
Right. They were relatively less impacted, if you can use that terminology, from the colonization process.
I don't know about that, but just that they have more of a political presence than we do here in the United States.
Right.
And they have a more of an international presence because the government is willing to fund them to do these delegations, which is not happening here.
So we got less than 20 minutes left. I did want to open it up to anyone who's got a burning question or comment. We've still got a couple other things to address here with my co-host today, Jacqueline Keeler, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Let me just really quickly finish this. The last paragraph I want to read just to give you the language of this statement from the Vatican. In no uncertain terms, the Church's magisterium upholds the respect due to every human being, the statement reads. The Catholic Church therefore repudiates those concepts that fail to recognize the inherent human rights of Indigenous peoples, including what has become known as the legal and political doctrine of discovery. That is totally unprecedented. So we definitely have to acknowledge that. But the question I had, and I don't imagine you would have an answer, is, and I think people have been trying to get at this, the Native people that have been addressing this over the decades, is there actually a formal process to revoke, because that's the term that some people have used, revoke the Doctrine of Discovery, revoke the papal bulls. Is there actually a formal process for doing that? And I'm curious.
Well, I think that one of the things is that it's a legal precedent, a doctrine. It's not a law.
Well, they could issue a new papal bull is what he should do, Pope Francis.
It would have to become, the courts in the United States would have to basically.
Right.
And so,
well, yeah, in terms of the effect it might have.
Yeah,
the
so I think what would have to happen, there would have to be court cases where it is overturned by, the most recent, time the Supreme Court considered it was in 2005 in the city of Sherrill, New York versus Oneida Nation of New York. And the city of Sherrill was under the impression that it was renting the land from the tribe. They'd done a rental agreement way back when, and we're worried that the rental agreement was up and that it clouded the deeds for people's property, and so they took it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled, you know, the Doctrine of Discovery of the United Nation of New York, even though it'd been there for thousands of years, had no title because it was not a discovering nation, right? So it could not issue title to the city of Sherrill, New York, and so. But that was that opinion was written by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She cited the Doctrine of Discovery in opposition to the United Nations' right to their own homeland. And so I think we would need the courts would have to overturn it case by case, or I think Congress could issue some kind of law or something. I think, but I doubt they would, because it would throw, like with the city of Sharon, it would throw so many places in the country, it would cloud the title that people have. And so I think it's highly unlikely that anything, it's so fundamental to U.S. claims to the land it occupies, right? It, to Native Nations land. Because not every treaty, not every place in this country has been covered by treaty. You know, I mean, the entire state of Nevada has no treaties with tribes that give it land. None. You know, they give, I mean, passage, you know, for the Oregon Trail. They don't give them the land. You know, yeah. There's so many places where the, and sometimes the treaties are an exact opposite of the present situation. You know, like look at the treaties that the Standing Rock Sioux tribe were invoking. You know, which gives them everything west of the Missouri River and south of the Heart River. That's like a quarter of North Dakota. It's like, you know, they have to return the land. You know, and I don't know. I just don't think there's the political will in this country.
that's the understatement of the year. Okay, yeah. So let's leave that. I think that's we've gotten to a good point in that. Well, we've got the kind of current. Results of the colonization in the Supreme Court fight over the water rights to the Little Colorado and Colorado River and the Navajo people and the other tribes affected. We've been talking about the doctrine of discovery. Well, let's go 50 years back and talk about the epic occupation of Wounded Knee and its legacy that continues. And let me just, here's an article from Common Dreams, 50 Years On, Legacy of Wounded Knee Uprising Lives in Indigenous Resistance. Quote, "We're not the subjugated and disenfranchised people that we were," said one Ponca elder who took part in the 1973 revolt. Wounded Knee was an important beginning of that.
Yeah, I would say that Wounded Knee was, you know, along with Alcatraz, these were really seminal moments in my parents' generation and in their activism. And so, yeah, I think it's the second Wounded Knee usually called, because in 1890 was when the Wounded Knee massacre occurred there, and which I've mentioned before on the show. My grandmother's uncle was the he was a young Dakota man who was an Episcopal priest, and he turned his church into a hospital to for, you know, he worked with another young Dakota man named Dr. Charles Eastman, and the two of them, they rode out into the blizzard to try to save as many people as they could. And my grandmother said that her uncle lost his faith in that in the American church way, and then died 2 years later, she said, of a broken heart. He was a young man. And the second Wounded Knee, which happened in 1973, was really these were just, you know, I'm having grown up after those dates, really in the world that was created by them and by the Red Power movement, it was really, you know, it really changed sort of what it meant to be American Indian, you know, and that can't be you know, it was really quite crucial. I would add, though, that, I did work on an article, I think it was for the 40th anniversary, and it's about 10 years ago, and I interviewed people from Wounded Knee, the village, and they told quite a different story. I was actually kind of shocked. They claimed that that their community had been destroyed without their consent. And
there's always another side to the story, isn't there?
Yes, yeah. I mean, they're interviewing this Ponca guy, but, you know, they should talk to some of the local and I was really surprised, and I was like, is this accurate? What, am I getting a weird read on this? Or, because, of course, that's not at all how I understood it. And so I talked to the late Chuck Trimble, who is a Lakota journalist who was raised at Wounded Knee. That's his hometown. And I asked him, I said, you know, what, I'm hearing this stuff. What's your take on it? You know? And he's like, oh, well, they're both right. And I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, they're both right. I mean, and our community was destroyed, never rebuilt. I mean, you know, it sounds like you're talking about very impoverished people, and to them, having a gas station nearby is really important, because otherwise they had to drive, now they have to drive all the way to Pine Ridge, you know, another 40 miles to get gas, and the destruction of their little store there. Those are things that are devastating to the community and have never been replaced. And so, and it just impoverishes them more. So, and when I was covering Standing Rock, I, you know, spoke to the community of Cannonball as well. And what I found was, once again, you know, people parachute in as activists, and then they make decisions that have long-lasting impacts on the community, but they don't actually get the community's consent. And this is really the opposite of the way I was trained as a community organizer, you know, where you go and you get a consent every step of the way, and you also let them decide strategy. And so I think, and in my book, Stand Up, I do go into this in some depth. And
Let me just read this just to give people the, because there may be people not thoroughly familiar with what it actually was all about. So let me just read a paragraph here, and then we can, because this is really interesting. I hadn't thought that the discussion would go in this way, and I think it's really important. Okay, so on February 27th, 1973, around 300 Oglala Lakota and members of the American Indian Movement, seething from centuries of injustices ranging from genocide to leniency for whites who committed crimes against Indians, occupied the hamlet of Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Reservation for more than 2 months. The uprising occurred during a period of increased Native American militancy and the rise of AIM, the American Indian Movement, which first drew international attention in 1969 with the 19-month occupation of Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay. And then they have interview more with this Duane Camp, the Ponca elder who took part in the revolt, and it's a whole article worth checking out. There's a lot of stuff on it. This one is particularly from Common Dreams. So I guess my impression, having read some history, I mean, because there's, you know, it was an amazing phenomenon, right? I mean, you agree with that, but you also see the other side. It really uplifted the profile of Native Americans. It raised issues that hadn't been able to be raised. It brought a bunch of people into activism. It had a major impact. But you know, some of the leaders were, you know, let's face it, to some extent dysfunctional people, kind of a lot of macho guys. And frankly, they were pretty much just winging it, right? I mean, they were just making kind of decisions on the fly. So they, not necessarily all that much thought and planning went into it. Is that right?
The way I understood it growing up and when I was taught in college was that, you know, it was this, what you just described. But when I spoke to people from the community itself, they felt invaded. I mean, like, they didn't feel like this was actually, you know, their issue, and they didn't know why it had to be done in their community, and then why these activists never came back and rebuilt their community. I mean,
right.
And so, I was, like I said, I was quite shocked when I was told these things. I thought, am I just getting a weird read on this? Like, just hit a vein of people who are contrary? I mean, and so that's why I asked other people about it, from the community and particularly Chuck Trimble, who was, you know, renowned, Lakota journalist. And his answer, you know, well, both of those things are correct, right? Was not, and at that point I realized, like, wow, am I just like 40 years too late to the story? Like, how do I ascertain who I think is more correct? I mean, because, you know, you go on the ground on Pine Ridge and you talk to people and you get all kinds of different, you hear all kinds of things, you know, and you kind of have to assess out which can you actually report on, which is legitimate, which is just people who have a gripe, that kind of stuff. You know, they call giapi, gossip, you know, and so it's like, I was pretty surprised, I think it did have a huge impact. Like I said, you know, I mean, I grew up as a kid, I remember in Denver, we would stand at powwows and honor people who had been at Wounded Knee, you know, veterans, and stuff, I remember that, you know, and so I was raised with to basically have a veneration for it, and you know, a lot of, but it is questionable, but the whole thing of like, well, why didn't they rebuild the community if they cared so much about it? That's the part that kind of...
Well, because they were moving on to the next, you know, the next big thing, right?
Yeah, they're not really part of the community. They're not really invested in the what the community will endure and suffer, do you mean? And so that's why I call it parachuting in, that kind of activism. You know, even if you're from another tribe, you know, that's a different nation, do you know what I mean? It's really not, it'd be like, you know, a Belgian coming in deciding, you know, I don't know, Lithuania's foreign policy. Do you know what I mean? It's just sort of like, yeah, okay, you know, but I mean, it's not really your right or your role.
Yeah, no, well, that's, so let's, we have one caller, and we only have a couple minutes left. Let's go to George. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Paul. I want to thank you so much. This is such an interesting and valuable program. And I was wondering if you and your co-host could mention, is there a good book that really with maps or without maps, but with references that's available now, used or new? Be nice to have something that's really available, giving the Native American point of view and that Jacqueline has been expressing.
Okay, well, thank you.
Sure. Okay. I'll just get off the line here and take my answer over the air.
Go ahead, Jackie.
I don't know. Well, there's my book, Standoff, which I think has enough maps in it or not. But, yeah, so I guess no, definitely would recommend I'd recommend off the top of my head, sorry, particularly on this issue. I think, you know, there's been a lot of, I have, you know, there's issues with different history books that I have that I don't really want to discuss right now. But yeah, but you can check out my book, Standoff, which has a lot of its history as well. So.
Okay. There's a couple other quick things. Well, we probably don't have time. I just thought that one article I sent you about these new discoveries in Kansas about this kind of what archaeologists hadn't historians hadn't known hardly anything about, that just overturns the history of central, you know, the heartland of Turtle Island, North America. It's just fascinating, this whole civilization that lived there in the plains, which I guess is no surprise to you, probably.
Well, yeah, I was familiar with that place called, is it really a large city?
Quivira.
Yeah, I can't read it. Right now, but it's yeah, the and I was always shocked.
Oh, that's me. That's me. That's me.
Yeah. So yeah, the what's that place called? I think it's in Illinois.
Cahokia.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, sort of down river. I mean, so to speak, down the Missouri River from where my dad's people are from, right? And it's just sort of, I think it is, yeah, it's in St. Louis, South of St. Louis. And so, yeah, and I guess what coming to grasp with the idea that, you know, I've always, when you're out there on the Great Plains and it just seems so remote, and I always envisioned my ancestors living, you know, as they were, you know, but the idea that they may have actually been part of a much more urban, these large cities, you know, being around. I mean, Cahokia is said to have been been the size of London at the same time. Like, it was a major 150,000 people living there, and this is kind of shocking to think that they may have been living in a much more, you know, or in 1,000 years ago in a much more urban environment. And
200,000 yeah. people in this is
a
city, yeah, and it's just
yeah. And I think
this is in the Great Plains, this advanced, yes. Well, so-called advanced civilization.
It is really shocking. There's so much we don't know. I mean, you know, once, you know, we don't have that history because so many people died of disease when the, you know, Europeans came. I mean, we were looking at sort of the...
they talked about the Santa Fe slave trade, where they started getting slaves from those peoples, those nations, and that was kind of the beginning of the demise. of that particular. But yeah, anyway, I just wanted to flag that. I actually had the article up, but it started talking back to me over the air. So I had to close it. Yeah. So I don't have the reference for it. But it's, I think, out of Wichita State or something. Anyway, I think we're all out of time, though. Last thought before we close?
Well, I would say definitely check out the Pretendian issue. We had two major stories break this week that were widely covered. And we had Heather Rae Bybee revealed as a fake Cherokee. The other story would be, I really cover a lot of issues on corruption, even in Indian country, and the Honor the Earth and Winona LaDuke's lawsuit, which they lost. I would definitely recommend people to look into that because it's important that we have good people representing us.
We got to go. Thank you so much, Jacqueline Keeler. Sure. Appreciate it. Okay. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
Getting so near, rocking our hearts, rocking the res. Carrying on like he ain't been gone. Warmaker's back.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
If capitalism has proven to be